Northwestern University presents The Reviewing Stand, a national forum devoted to public analysis of current events. Through radio discussion, The Reviewing Stand attempts to bring a clearer picture of the news as we live it today. To analyze the question, should war criminals be punished, Northwestern University has invited as its panel guests David Bryn Jones, chairman of the Department of International Relations, Carleton College, Leon Green, dean of the School of Law, Northwestern University, Arthur P. Scott, professor of modern history, University of Chicago, and Curtis McDougall of the Medill School of Journalism, Northwestern University. Participating on the program as reviewing stand moderator will be James H. McBurney, dean of Northwestern School of Speech. Don't forget that you may obtain a copy of today's broadcast for 10 cents or the current series of 26 issues for $1. Please address all inquiries to the reviewing stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, or to station WGN, Chicago. And now to friends across the nation and to guests gathered here in Mutual's WGN studios in Chicago, Northwestern University presents The Reviewing Stand and the question, should war criminals be punished?
Following the last war, the Commission on War Responsibility accomplished little in the way of punishing war criminals. Indeed, in 1919, the attitude of the Allied powers was apathetic, if not openly opposed to such punishment. Today, we appear to face a very different situation. A rising tide of sentiment in favor of the vigorous prosecution of the criminals of World War II. Especially is this true of the governments in exile, whose peoples have felt the full force of the Nazi Fuhrer under German occupation. It is reported that the Polish Committee alone has recorded evidence against 4,000 Nazi henchmen who have committed atrocious crimes in Poland. The question then is, should these war criminals be punished? Unless this question is answered carefully, convincingly, and I think soon, we may suffer a serious wave of extra-legal retribution in Europe after the war is over. Now, to get this problem before us, gentlemen, I suggest that we begin by defining what we mean by a war criminal or a war crime. How do you men see this? May we hear from you, Bryn Jones?
I think it's very important to recognize that in the public mind, there are three senses in which the term war crime is used. First, and most generally, when people speak of the crime of the war, they're thinking of the responsibility for the war, the invasions of Poland, of Holland, and of Norway, and so on. That is the most general sense, and of course, it carries us far beyond the main purpose of this discussion. Secondly, I think that people have in mind those actions which have violated and affronted what I'd called the civilized conscience, what would be called popularly atrocities, of which there have been a great many. And then thirdly, we come to the more technical sense in which the term is used, that is, a crime involving a violation of a particular article or convention recognized in international law. When we use the term in this third sense, we are using a legal or a quasi-legal term. And of course, there have been evidences of crimes of this particular kind. The shooting of hostages, the bombing of a city which has been declared an open city, as in the case of Manila. In any one of these three senses, we may profitably discuss what policy should be adopted in relation to war crimes. But I think it is very important that we should keep the distinctions clear in our mind.
That's a helpful classification. I'd like to ask about the third. To what extent are the conventions or rules of war codified and recognized in international law, Bryn Jones?
The laws of the nations, unfortunately, have not been codified. There are certain documents, the Hague Conventions in particular, for instance, treaties and so on, which are the bases of international law. But it is still true that international law suffers from the fact that there is no authorized body for its interpretation and no authorized body for the application of any sanctions which may be imposed under it. In that sense, international law is quasi-law rather than law in the strict sense of the term.
How do you see this, Dean Green? Do you think we are concerned here mainly with legal crimes?
No, I do not. I don't see the clear line of distinction between one and three. It seems to me the people who plan the invasions and who worked out the theories of invasions and what they would do, in other words, the waging of total war in the neighboring countries of Germany, for instance, part and parcel of this whole picture of war criminals. I don't see how we could make any distinction between that group and the group who actually carry out the orders of the people on top.
I'm not suggesting that there is any distinction in the sense in which Dean Green means. What I do mean is that the three kinds of crimes necessitate different procedures. You can imagine a court trying a legal issue, but I don't think you can envisage any court that is to try the question of war responsibility.
McDougall?
Well, because the international law is so ill-defined, it seems to me that we are concerned with the more important aspect of moral law, which changes from war to war. If we took international law as the criterion, we must remember the example, for instance, of the German submarines last time, which in the eyes of the American public was an atrocity, and which this time is not. And McBurney, in your introductory remarks, you spoke of the rising feeling for punishment of the war criminals, mostly in the occupied countries. I think also, however, we must take cognizance of a antithetical attitude, which is very strong among the American people, some segments of them, that modern warfare is one in which the no holds are barred, in which atrocities are accepted methods, in which the only difference is which side does it, that anything goes.
Well, I think we all have encountered that attitude, that anything goes in modern warfare. How do you see that?
Well, I don't agree at all. I believe that our enemies have used what we call atrocities this time as a matter of major strategy, and that some of those policies are ones which the Americans never conceivably would use. For instance, the bombing of open cities, which has been mentioned, the wiping out of cities, as was done in the case of Ladiche, the killing of hostages. I believe that if an American general were to occupy a city and use any of those methods, that he would be overwhelmingly denounced by the public opinion in this country.
Do we have any disagreement on that?
No
disagreement, except that it doesn't affect what I have said about the importance of the distinction. I think you could try whoever may have been responsible for the particular crime of ordering the shooting of hostages. But I doubt very much whether you could have a trial in which the question of war responsibility would be decided.
Now, let me come to your point this way. Now, we all know that the Nazis have been charged with the cold-blooded murder of civilians, the shooting of hostages, and all sorts of brutal atrocities. Now, how many of these crimes are covered by international law? Most of them are simply violations of common decency, aren't they?
The moral law. There are very serious violations of actual conventions. The shooting of hostages, of course, is the most dramatic of them, the most serious of them. The bombing of an open city, as in the case of Manila. These, of course, there is looting, which has been charged against the Germans and others to an extent which is unprecedented in previous wars. All these are clear violations of conventions of law. And they are capable of legal determination and of legal trial.
Now, you mentioned in your early remarks, Burne Jones, a third category, which seems to be of a somewhat different order, and involves the question of war responsibility. I'd like to ask this and see what you think of it, Scott. Do you think that the makers of war should be classed as war criminals? As we have been talking about persons who committed crimes after war was declared, how about those who plotted and fomented the war to begin with? Perhaps munition makers and others who stood to profit by it.
Well, to a certain extent, they are also responsible. I think the war criminals fall in three levels. The higher-ups and the lower-downs and the peoples of the aggressive Axis nations as a whole.
But if you're going to deal with this matter of war responsibility, doesn't it have to be assessed, Dean Green, on a national basis before individual responsibility can be determined?
No, I don't think so. I think in this case that the necessity of getting at the people who have violated the conventions of, I won't say civilized warfare, but the conventions accepted by civilized countries in waging war is a preliminary problem. Long before we get to the problem of trying to work out a means of properly punishing, if you use that term, at least dealing with, the populations. Here are the individual people who have clearly gone beyond anything that we've known in prior wars and have subjected civilian populations especially to torture, to ravishing, to burnings, to things that are utterly unheard of in any civilized countries heretofore. And those people, those individuals who are responsible, are those who, in my mind, fit the category of war criminals. Now, they may be high up, they may be low down. Any person who has had the choice in dealing with civilian populations, especially in other countries, who has taken advantage of his position to inflict these terrors and these tortures upon the population, fall in that class and should be dealt with first, it seems to me.
McDougal?
Well, Green, I think what Bryn Jones meant in his definition and what McBurney meant in his question is the responsibility prior to September 1st, 1939 on the part of our diplomats and on the part of our peoples for the war. And if we tried to pin that responsibility and punish for it, you and I would be included somewhat among the list of criminals. It seems to me that's utterly impossible. We should rule that out.
Exactly. Isn't the question of war responsibility beside the point for the purpose of our discussion? Because it seems to me that what happens there will be a matter for the peace settlement. The peace settlement will take into account the responsibility of the various parties to the war.
In other words, we're concerned principally with these violations of international law and crimes against natural and moral law.
Yes, I would say so, although I don't wish to rule out the question as to whether the German people and the German government are both responsible in a way which merits some suitable procedure and relationship.
And that brings me to a related second question. We have been attempting here to define what we mean by a war crime. I wonder if it wouldn't be helpful to ask the question, who are the war criminals, Scott?
Well, I suggested that they were higher-ups. By the higher-ups, I mean the responsible planning heads of the governments and also the economic men who and military men who helped them out.
Do you think that the soldiers who commit war atrocities can be held responsible?
Not in general. If they go beyond their orders, yes.
Yes,
do you think, Mr. Green, that the commissioners that are in charge, for instance, in Holland and in France and in Czechoslovakia, Seyss-Inquart in Holland and so on, could they be held responsible for the shooting of hostages that take place under their administration?
I think the Hitler gang proper, starting with Hitler, Goering, Goebbels, Himmel, Rosenberg, Hess, that whole group would fall within the scope of war criminals, and then the administrators that have been set over Poland and Holland and Belgium and who carry out these orders and who have a great deal of discretion in carrying them out would all fall within the group of war criminals.
Now, isn't there a legal presumption, Green, that an officer or soldier is not responsible in his own person for the execution of orders coming from a superior?
Oh, I think that's true. We're not talking about that. Of course, if
that was used in the last war, wasn't it, to protect many people.
Oh, I think so. But, of course, if some, any soldier from the lowest to the highest should depart, leave the reservation, so to speak, as they commit rape, go out on a detour of his own of enforcing things that fall within his own power, why, I think he should be punished, though he might be so small that we should never get him in the net that we are thinking about in this occasion.
The criterion, then, is one of discretion
and choice.
Yeah.
I think there would be some advantage in spending a moment with you to dispose of crime in the simpler sense. Can we set up a court for the trial of what I would call the strictly legal offenses which may be committed? And if so, what kind of court?
Well, wouldn't you leave that to the particular countries that where the crimes were perpetrated, the smaller ones, and not involve it in the problem that we are dealing with?
I think that in the case of the so-called Quislings, there, of course, you have a clear case of treason with which the government of Norway or the government of Poland would be able to deal. But there are a great many of these crimes. The shooting of hostages would involve a number. What kind of court would be set up to try them, and what kind of court would be set up to try the higher-ups, as you call them?
I wonder if we can't come to that question just a little later, Bryn Jones. We're speaking to the point, who are the war criminals? And we seem to be pretty much agreed that we're concerned, for the most part, with these arch criminals. I would like to ask, though, about the responsibility of the peoples of the Axis nations. To what extent should they be held responsible for the deeds of their government? After all, they appear to support these governments. Are we going to absolve them?
Not at all, but problems like that would be taken care of in the peace treaty. You can't condemn a whole nation or shoot or hang a whole nation.
Well, I think also our perspective should be entirely toward the future, but I think we can go altogether too far in saying we're fighting only the leaders of the German people. We have no war with the people themselves. As a strictly practical matter, there are mitigating circumstances, of course, to explain how the Germans came to support Hitler, how the Japanese people became so fanatical. But from the practical point of view of the future peace of the world, we are faced with the question, is some punishment nevertheless justified, just as we punish a child regardless of how much he's been tempted by somebody else? And there I think that we must consider the German people as a whole as criminals with mitigating circumstances.
But that's not our problem here this morning. We are dealing here purely with the individual responsibility.
Well, we're defining what is a war criminal.
Yes, and in that we mean that there are certain people you can put your finger on.
Well, I say they're all criminals.
Well, in that sense, then you could say the whole world is criminal.
That's
because
right.
We are more or less irresponsible.
Well,
dealing with that problem.
On that particular point, I think it's rather important to keep clear in mind that the punishment of the German people will come from the result of the war, defeat and the destruction which precedes it, and the sufferings which will produce that surrender. All these will be part of the punishment of the German people for their responsibility for their government. Beyond that, our task will be not so much to punish, but to see that the German people shall never again be able to do what was done in 39 and in the years that followed.
Well, that's just exactly the point. I want to be sure that when the war ends, that the German people have felt that they have punished enough. I feel that the Russians and the Poles and the Czechs, for instance, also must be satisfied. You can call it revenge, you can call it savagery, you can call it barbarity if you wish. But that's something we have to get out of our system if we're going to sit down at a peace table and write a treaty with our point of view toward the future.
Yeah, I agree with your point in one particular especially, and that is, one of the things that will help to avert what may be a bloodbath of unprecedented proportions in Europe will be the assurance given to Czechs and Poles and so on, that we do not intend to allow sentimentality to rule in relation to the treatment of the enemy nations.
But there are many Americans who would like to have this country right now assure the Germans and the Italians that we will not permit the Russians, Czechs, and Poles to overrun their countries, and I certainly hope we don't do that.
Well, how could we do that? There's no possibility of this country checking Russia and even the countries that have been overrun. We can throw in our moral weight, and we can act as one of the United Nations. But I think, as was just stated, that the assurance on the part of the United Nations that we are going to deal in an orderly way with the individuals who are most responsible, not only for these excesses and cruelties that have taken place, will tend to ameliorate not only the fears, but the spirit of revenge of the other countries.
Isn't there a touch of self-righteousness in the assumption that the Russians will be more violent than we or the British would be in invading Germany? In any case, what the Russians will do if they invade Germany is something which we have little chance of being able to influence.
It's not exactly self-righteousness. We are realizing that those people have suffered tremendously more, and we haven't, and we feel like we would not be as extreme in to the lengths to which we would go in taking vengeance.
Well, now, gentlemen, if these war criminals should be punished, and we seem to be proceeding on that assumption, I'd like to raise the question, how should it be done? What tribunal should be set up? What court should have jurisdiction? How should this be handled? Green?
Well, my ideas on this will probably run counter to those of most people. I feel like that we ought not to think about courts in the sense of an international court. It seems to me the Allied nations should set up a high commission which would take charge of this matter of punishing war criminals. Now, there'd be two branches of it. One, the branch of gathering the information and ferreting out who are the criminals, and two, deciding whom to prosecute, because out of, let's say, 10,000, why, they would eliminate a very large percentage of them as too small. After all, this thing of trying people is a long process, and you want to make this effective and simple and swift and just, so that people in the future will look back upon it as an orderly, fair type of process with dealing with people in this type of situation.
How do you see that, Mr.?
My feeling is that the more impartial you can make your court, the better it will be. In my opinion, an inter-allied or an United Nations commission will not carry conviction either in Germany or in the neutral nations, or will completely satisfy ourselves in the long run. We will have an uneasy conscience, and an uneasy conscience can be very disastrous, as is proved in the history of the 30s in Great Britain. I think that there is a possibility that the International Court of Justice might be entrusted with this task. It would be difficult to secure its efficient operation, no doubt, but I think at least it suggests a possibility.
I feel that the International Court, or any purely legal tribunal, is entirely too formal, and the processes are too slow and too cumbersome. It seems to me that here you'll set up, the High Commissioner, say, will select a panel of very distinguished people from all walks of life, from all the countries, and in particular cases will assign a group of men to hear the evidence as presented by the fact finders and the prosecutors, and accord to the accused, whoever it may be, the fullest opportunity to be heard, both by himself and by counsel. But not prolong the thing too greatly. Simply have it fairly and swiftly done, and let it be final.
And what do you mean by final? What kind of punishment would you have needed?
I would suggest that here we are only after the extreme cases, and there should be only one penalty, and that would be death. And inasmuch as it's death of someone we consider a shameless person rather than a soldier or someone who's done an honorable thing, why it should be by hanging rather than any other form.
That's a bit vigorous, isn't it? How do you see that, Scott?
I sympathize individually with the idea of hanging a number of these higher-ups. However, in my capacity as a historian looking forwards and backwards, I feel that it would not be wise, would not be speedy in many instances.
Do you agree with that?
I think that the important thing, even with regard to the treatment of war criminals, is, as McDougall said earlier, to look to the future rather than to the past. My fear is that if you hang Hitler or Goering or any of them, you will tend to make national heroes of them and will tend to perpetuate the very thing you're trying to eradicate.
Stan?
I was looking up on the Congress of Vienna a couple of weeks ago for the class that I'm teaching in military government. I ran across what they had to say about Napoleon Bonaparte when he came back from Elba. They declared that Napoleon Bonaparte has placed himself without the pale of civil and social relations, and that as an enemy and a disturber of the tranquility of the world, he has rendered himself liable to public vengeance. Now, they thought just as badly of Napoleon in those days as we think of some of our main enemies now, and yet all they did was put him on St. Helena.
I don't think Napoleon was as bad as Hitler, but I do believe that if Napoleon had been summarily disposed of instead of being sent to St. Helena, we would have had a different world. It's always been true that the general populace says, well, you'll never do anything with the higher-ups. It seems to me there's a fundamental point of justice involved here, that if these people who cause all of the trouble are not going to receive the full extent of the punishment we can give them, why, there's no such thing as ever in the history of the world preventing just such gangsterism as has occurred in this war.
Well, I think the most important point of all, it can be said in just a few words, we've got to get rid of these fellows and get them out of the world so they don't continue as a potential threat to the peace of the world in the future.
Nobody's having them hanging around. They're no good.
Well, not alive.
Don't you think that
getting
most
on that word, hanging around.
Don't you think that the most important thing is to see to it that such persons will not have the capacity or the power to do what they did now, rather than to wreak vengeance?
Why didn't you deal with Dillinger that way?
I agree with eliminating Hitler and send him to exile if you like. But what I'm concerned about is that anything that is done must meet the moral approval of the world if it's going to have long-range consequences and effects.
Do you doubt that the whole world would feel like that justice had been meted out if those people were hanged?
I'm rather concerned about the feeling of Germany, who we may hope in the long process of time will be a part of the civilized world.
Do you think we're going to punish these criminals to satisfy the Germans?
No, we're going to punish them because justice demands it, and there are practical, expedient reasons. For instance, the satisfaction of the resentment of the occupied countries and of those oppressed peoples who have suffered so much, in my opinion, that will mean a mitigation of the possibilities of violence after the war.
Well, gentlemen, I think that we may summarize the attitude of this group, certainly as one favoring the vigorous prosecution of the arch-war criminals under the provisions of international law and the dictates of common decency and morality. This to be done without malice toward the people of the Axis nations and in the interests of the political and social rehabilitation of these countries along constructive lines.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand analysis of the topic, Should War Criminals Be Punished? With David Bryn Jones, Chairman of the Department of International Relations, Carleton College, Leon Green, Dean of the School of Law, Northwestern University, Arthur P. Scott, Professor of Modern History, University of Chicago, and Curtis McDougall, Medill School of Journalism, Northwestern University. If you wish a copy of today's broadcast for 10 cents or the current series of 26 issues for $1, please write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, or Station WGN, Chicago.
Next Sunday, we shall analyze the role of the engineer in winning victory for the United Nations. Guests at the Reviewing Stand microphone will be Earl T. Compton, President of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, William E. Wickenden, President of the Case School of Applied Science, Henry T. Heal, President of the Illinois Institute of Technology, and Arthur W. Eschbach, Dean of the Northwestern University Technological Institute. We invite you to join our audience next week at this same hour for the Reviewing Stand discussion, What America Asks of the Engineer.
The Northwestern University Reviewing Stand is broadcast every Sunday over the coast-to-coast mutual network from station WGN in Chicago. Jack Callahan speaking. This is Mutual.